Interaction Insights excerpts from Dr. Mortimer R. Feinberg's Practical Psychology for Managing People continues now with the secrets of selecting people who will perform.
So let's look at this very important characteristic of selecting people. And I guess we first have to look at the interview itself. The interview, of which most of you are quite familiar. And can you pick up those qualities of successful identification of management potential? I like to refer to it as EIMP, the early identification of management potential. And I want to point out that you have a responsibility to make certain when you do the interview that you have selected a future leader. One of the saddest aspects of Richard Nixon's TV retrospective was inadvertent revelation of his major failure, he said, as of an executive. He said he had not been a good butcher in that he allowed compassion for his subordinates like Ehrlichman and Haldeman to postpone their firing. Was this a real deficiency? In most cases, the major error is not in retaining the undesirable subordinate, but having picked him in the first place. Nixon didn't discuss that part of it. Management consultants such as myself are familiar with the dirges of chief executives who say they got into trouble because they didn't fire fast enough. The rationalization is never used by effective president because he knows that the place to be tough is at the point of hiring. Insofar as Mr. Nixon's complaints about his staff explain his own ultimate failure, they leave open the question of why he made the initial hiring decision that contributed to his downfall. Presumably, his subordinates were considered and were competent, but obviously something more than competence was needed. If a chief executive chooses staff only for their skills, he may be missing equally important attributes. To begin with, one of the most common mistakes made by top executives in the selection process is to look for a mirror image. Somebody who thinks like us, reinforces what we consider our strong points. We don't like to think of ourselves as having weaknesses, and therefore we don't hire people who can fill voids left in our own performance. Wise British monarchs used a systematic institution in ancient times to correct this tendency. Knowing their own propensities for wielding absolute power, they set up the office of chancellor, one who would serve as the keeper of the king's conscience. As a general rule, the executive can determine the competence of job candidates through objective data, investigation of his past record, education, training, the jobs he's held successfully as evidenced by length of tenure, the observations of his associates. They're usually recited in application forms, work records, references. But they're hardly enough to go on. We used to hire just the base of education. First was a college graduate, we hired him right away. That's untrue. Just education alone is no criterion. The basic point in hiring decisions is that the best educational credentials should be only one of a series of criteria. Depending on the nature of the job, it may even be one of the least important items, outweighed by factors like job knowledge, experience, interest in type of work. Really, what we're looking for in the early identification of men and women who can move up the ladder of success is the question revolving around the following. Is the individual likely to work to capacity? Remember that word, work to capacity. The issue is not one of laziness, but rather are their personality characteristics that block the fulfillment of an individual's personal potential. Does the individual reach too far beyond capacities so that frustration halts development? Or does he shoot for new targets, somewhat higher than past achievements, so that the next steps are clearly attainable and therefore invite increased effort and a stretching of capacity? How a person responds to success and failure may be just as important as the abilities he brings to the situation. Dr. Kurt Lewin, founder of the science of group dynamics, notes the same achievements may cause a feeling of success or a feeling of defeat, depending on the sequence of events and on individual personality. An athlete throws a discus 40 yards at the same time, first time, 50 yards the second time, 65 the third time. On each occasion, he feels successful. On the next try, he throws 50 yards again. The same achievement that made him elated only a few moments before now leave him defeated. Statistical studies of reactions, as described by Dr. Lewin, indicate how varied the personal responses may be. Not only is the level of aspiration fundamental to the experience of success and failure, but with the level of aspiration itself has changed by success and failure. After a success, a person generally sets himself into a higher standard. After failure, his level of aspirations generally goes down. Since reactions to success or failure differ so much, the hiring interviewer must seek to ascertain how the particular interviewee is likely to respond. No hard or fast conclusions may emerge, but you, as the hiring executive, can obtain useful information by getting the candidate to talk about his long-range objectives and sub-goals he perceives along the road. And I started with comments from the Old Testament. Now let me move to the New Testament. The great St. Thomas Aquinas once said that a man's life can be evaluated based upon his answer to three questions. What does he believe in? What does he hope for? And what does he love? Now, maybe that gets a little abstract, so let me make it more specific. The interviewer can derive some sense of how an individual feels about aspects of his immediate job. The believe in, the hope for, the love can come maybe as a cap to the interview. How does he feel about monetary compensations and status symbols? Are they close enough to his next step aspirations, and are they pointed towards his long-range goals? What about the nature of the work? Do tasks have an intrinsic interest because they are consonant with his goals? Potential for self-fulfillment. In view of his level of aspiration, does the immediate job allow for his ego investment? In hiring a subordinate, you are putting his whole personality on the payroll, not just his professional competence. The interviewer should therefore seek to establish the individual's attitude towards himself. The usual attributes, of course, must be considered: self-confidence, reliability, and I will discuss that in a moment. But how he views himself is something that I would like you to stress when you do your interview. I'm afraid that what we are facing in most cases is a perfunctory interview, which doesn't get into the depths of the man. And remember what I said at the beginning. It's just like at a funeral of somebody who died of cancer. The tragedy was not at the funeral. The tragedy was the day the diagnosis was made. So I would like to give you some guidelines about what to look for. I've told you to look for, to get at some areas of his image of himself against the following primary consideration. Is there that there are no good guys and bad guys in the world. Everybody has strengths and weaknesses. The real question is, what strengths or weaknesses do you need at a given time in the history of the organization? Organizations go through stages, the way individuals go through stages. My father used to refer to it as aspiring, perspiring, and expiring. Entrepreneurial, growth, mature, and aging. Different people are needed at different stages of an organization's growth. I call them dreamers, schemers, reamers, and healers. The dreamer has certain characteristics. He asks the question. Other people say, why? And as John Kennedy used to say, I ask, why not? A Charles Revson, who comes out with nothing but a nail polish, can build an empire. A Lenny Florence of Toll Silver can start with a little frame. And Ed Yule of Fairchild Industries starts out with a little boy out of Elizabeth, New Jersey. His mother worked as in a laundry and now heads one of the largest aerospace companies in the United States. These are men who dream and who ask, why not? Second, though, the problem with most of the dreamers lies in the fact they run out of cash. Because they're always dreaming for products that take up a lot of money. So now you need the eye shade guy to come in because the banks say, what does it cost? And the dreamer doesn't know anything about costs. So you bring in the eye shade guy. He's the what we call in psychoanalytic terms the anal personality. He holds on to everything. He's got tight sphincters and tight pockets. And that's great. You need him at a certain time because you run out of cash. You know, he'll tell you it costs you 2.5 cents to produce this tape and you got to sell 18,000 before you make your cutoff points. The dreamer doesn't care. He just wants that tape. Schemer needed at that point. Then you have the reamer. That's where the problem with the schemer lies, that you have no direction. So the reamer, he comes in with the direction. We are going to market this tape to every single nurse and doctor in the United States. We're going to be like the dentist and fill every cavity. You know, a friend of mine is Wallace Rasmussen, former chairman of Beatrice Foods. He defined an expert reamer as somebody who knows how much dynamite to shove up the rear of a bull to blow off his horns without creating bloodshot eyes. Then you have the healer. He's the smiling Eisenhower, charismatic Jerry Ford type. And that's the end of the company when you bring in the healer, because he's so sensitive to the sensuous aspects of the battlefield that he just takes you right over the hill. So what you need in a man or woman that you are going to select is to understand, does that person, that man or woman, do they have the dreaming characteristics, the reaming characteristic, the scheming characteristic, the healing characteristic? Remember, different things are necessary. So I want to point out, by the way, that you need not be the most popular person when you select an individual. Don't look for popularity in your future identifications of the men and women who will dominate American industry. I'm a great admirer of Peter Drucker, the management guru of the last 20 years. Peter said, there's a tremendous stress these days on hiring people, who like to help people, who get along with people as an only criterion for a manager. Drucker said, these alone are never enough. In every organization, there is one boss who does not like people, who does not necessarily want to help them. He may be cold, he may be unpleasant, he may be demanding. He often teaches and develops more men, however, than anyone else. He commands more respect than the most likable men. He demands exacting workmanship of himself as well as of his men. He sets high standards and expects that they will be lived up to. He considers only what is right and never who is right. And though often himself a man of brilliance, he never rates the intellectual brilliance above integrity in others. I have to add here another footnote when we're talking about hiring men and women of what we describe as early identification of management potential. Companies are more and more coming to me these days and saying, we want the entrepreneurial type. We want the guy who can start up companies. Because a lot of companies are going to be in serious trouble in the 1980s because of the explosion of the technology. And many companies are going to go down the drain and many talents will become obsolete. The question will be, how do we harvest those talents? Because the technology is going to run rampant in the 80s. And much of the things we now know will be replaced by significant changes in the technology, and some of the skills will become obsolete. The company's saying, get us entrepreneurs. You know, Feinberg, help us select entrepreneurs. Well, some time ago, the Management Digest pointed out the pluses and minuses in the entrepreneurial personality, and I agree with them. Let me just list them for you. When you're thinking about hiring an entrepreneur, the characteristics are useful in identifying potential candidates for promotion or for hiring. Not all of them are desirable. The positive qualities include the following: a strong need to succeed, enthusiasm about the product and the business, perseverance, creativity, competitiveness. On the other hand, certain negatives are likely to be found in the entrepreneurial personality, and some large organizations like General Electric and IBM, who keep saying they want entrepreneurs, may not be able to live with them. The negatives are difficulty in working with others, a reluctance to communicate freely, disruptiveness, that is interference with the operations of colleagues, obstinacy. Usually management is willing to take the trade-off because along with these negatives, there are certain compensatory leadership qualities. Strong ego, personal charisma, decisiveness, intuitive decision-making. You as intelligent managers must make your choices with a full awareness of the difficulties that the entrepreneur is likely to create. You must do so by following this process. One, weigh the advantages and disadvantages. In such a human profit and loss analysis, it is important to evaluate the extent to which the effectiveness of others will be impaired by the hard-driving entrepreneur. What will it benefit the company if the success of his project torpedoes other projects that are equally important? Two, minimizing the negative. A knowledge of the trade-off you have made tells you in what direction to anticipate trouble, even if you know you cannot eliminate it because it goes with the bargain. You can include in your plan some effort to contain the cost. Under favorable circumstances, you may be able to provide some balm to an aggrieved executive who thinks he has lost status, perhaps by expanding his responsibilities in another area. At worst, you know what areas need closer monitoring. The awareness that every major decision will have some negative aspects should not serve as a deterrent to action. The tough-minded are clear that hard choices lie ahead, and the times are more receptive to the tough stance, if not now, when? If not now, when? Let's look at the characteristics then. Let us take a hard look. And this, I will tell you, is based upon 30 years of testing executives. In our organization, we have seen 5,000 managers and rank-and-file subordinates as well. My wife has been an expert on the Rorschach test. We have three different approaches. We use an intelligence test, an ink blot test, an interview. And in fact, I might say that 33 years ago, I spent my honeymoon on a Rorschach camp while my wife was studying executives. So I've been getting this for a long time. I want to give you now a summary of my observations about executives. Maybe it's nothing more than a refinement of what I said earlier with regard to the Jethro quote. What should you look for? We pointed out the interview should look for how he responds to success and failure, what his levels of aspiration are, what are some of his important personality characteristics. What else? Specifically. Try to be as specific as possible. One, executives, managers should have the ability to meet people from all walks of life and talk with pleasure on a wide range of subjects. Why do I say this? What relevance is this? Is this just an academic approach? No, it is not. I'll tell you why it's not. It's because the more an executive is exposed to multiple stimuli, the more he'll be able to see how his product fits into the new world as we face the 80s. The ability at all times to work at a mad pace and sometimes with the reflectiveness and slow tempo of a Buddhist priest. That is not easy to do. The ability to turn your mind off and on as you need to reflect becomes an important characteristic. Next, the ability to drive people hard when necessary, yet to be subtle and tactful at other times. Next, a superior level of intelligence. We talked about that earlier, but let me review again. In the top 15% of the population is about all that's required. Not brilliance, but a certain level of intelligence which is above the average. Now, by the way, you can pick this up by psychological testing and by some educational achievements. Next, and by the way, this is all measurable. You can measure this. That is different aspects of intelligence. You know, intelligence is a multi splendid thing. Some people are very good in vocabulary, some in social comprehension, some in arithmetic, some in general information. I would say the characteristics that is most important for you to understand for an executive is his vocabulary, his ability to express himself, his social comprehension, and his arithmetic skills. These are very critical in the selection of managers who make it in the firing lines that I've observed. Next, the ability to understand what's happening to others, or what I call sensitivity as well as spontaneity. That is the ability to understand what's happening in people's minds. It doesn't mean that necessarily you go along with them. But at least you understand what that man opposite you is thinking. Now, executives vary in this ability. You know, I found that some executives are great on what masses of people will do, but are very poor on what the man opposite him is thinking. I know the president of a very large marketing company with whom I consult said to me, "I'm great on masses and terrible on asses." He says, "I'm great on what thousands of people will buy, but I don't understand what Ted is thinking as I sit across the table with him." And he said, "That's what I want you to help me with." Next, the ability to have poise and strength in presenting ideas. The ability to communicate an image of personal strength. People want the leader to look strong. They want the leader to look like he knows where he's going. You know, sometimes you have to be like the captain of the Titanic and convince your passengers you just stopped to pick up a little ice. Next, the ability to bring about agreement even when there are many diverse elements. That is, look for solutions instead of compromises. Simple illustration. One girl in the office likes the windows open. Another one can't stand the draft. The executive confronted with a problem, with this problem, won't open the window halfway. He'll rearrange the desks. Sincerity and honesty are prime characteristics for the manager of the 1980s. A good executive is not afraid to criticize, but he does it for the individual's own development. He doesn't lash out at people's limitations, but tries to maximize their strengths. He has to be able to work under pressure. A life of an executive is full of pressure. How does he handle himself? How does he function in the clutches? Suppose you're interviewing him. Does he suddenly have trouble with simple questions? How does he interact with you when you start criticizing or challenging? By the way, one simple way. Watch his hands and watch his eyes. His eyes start shivering and moving around, and his hands start shaking. You know you've hurt him, or you've put him under a lot of pressure. Next, the ability to be imaginative, to seek some novel solutions to old problems. Very important in some situations. Keeping abreast of the technology. Is he reading? Is he keeping abreast of what he should be learning? Is he think his education is over with because he stopped at a given point? Next, does he have the ability to know where he's deficient? One of the most important characteristics is the ability to know where you are weak. MacArthur wrote a poem to his son in which he said, "Build me a son who'll be strong enough to know when he is weak." Next, the executive must have drive commensurate with his intelligence. He may not have, you know, as I say, sometimes you can get a lot of drive with poor IQ and you're really in trouble. But he has to be able to drive, as we said, to realistic goals. A competent manager of the future does not have unrealistic goals. He doesn't use a Cadillac merchandising to sell a Lloyd. Nor will he make plans for $3 million a year on a $2 million budget. Next is the ability to use energy constructively. He must be able to direct his energy towards specific goals. He cannot be all over the place, fragmented, like Don Quixote. Next, he must be able to be dependable. What do I mean by dependable? I tell you, that can kill people when they say they will be there at a given time and they're not there. Or they say to Ted, "I will deliver that manuscript at a certain time," and or "I will deliver that management program or marketing program at a certain time," and he keeps falling behind his schedules. You know you're in trouble and you don't have a real comer in this individual. Next, he must be willing to listen, that is open-minded, must be able to see himself clearly. He must not have such a distorted view of himself that it's out of line with reality. Next, he should not be paranoid. By that paranoid, it means he should not be so distrustful of others that he can't at times unload. By the way, that's one of the big problems in handling attention, which I will discuss later, is the ability to unload to other people. Trouble with some executives, they're so tight, they're so fearful, that eventually they blow and blow themselves out of a window, which I have seen happen with some executives. Many poor executives are unable to branch out. By that I mean a good executive can leave what he's doing now, do something else, and come back. He doesn't say, "Well, I can't disrupt myself now." He's not like a computer that's got to go right down the line. He could, what they say in computer terms, branch out. Napoleon could do 7 things at once. Look for these traits in your subordinates. Next, and probably most important, a manager must have the appropriate combination of dependent and independent strivings. Now, what do I mean by that? It means he must balance his dependency needs against his leadership needs. Not easy to do. Where is the crux of it? The crux of it is in the family, in his relationships with his family, whether it's a male or female executive. By the way, one of the real problems now we have is with female executives balancing these pressures. The balance between independent and dependent strivings. You know one of the biggest problems that young cadets have? And by the way, if we were face-to-face or across the classroom, I would throw you a sugarless candy if you gave me a right answer at sugarless, because my bright students were getting diabetes, but I believe in giving primary reinforcement. One of the most important problems that young cadets have at West Point, or if this is an international audience, to some degree some of you might purchase a stipend internationally, it's our West Point. Yeah, it's our military academy, West Point. young cadets and the young married cadets, the ones, young graduates, have great problems with their marriage because they think they have to be macho all the time. They think they have to be very strong as the leader and the lieutenant and the military officer. It's a balance between your independent and your dependent strivings. Another very, very significant characteristic is decisiveness. The inability to make decisions is something that knocks out intellectuals frequently from the role of strong managers because intellectuals see too much of a problem. The come down to a decision-making is not as easy as people seem to think. People gnaw at it and are sicklied over with the pale cast of thought. A good executive can make decisions. And by the way, we can measure this. We can measure this by the interview, by psychological testing, and by the man's background. It becomes very important to understand the whole area of decision-making and the ability to finally come down on a given issue and say, this is where I stand. Next, the ability to take a witty or serious approach as circumstances warrant. I guess really the ability to laugh at oneself, which eases the tension of the executive arena. Taking yourself so seriously is a negative. The ability to laugh at yourself becomes critical. The ability to be conservative sometimes, but at other times to take risks. To know when to take the risk and when to be conservative, to isolate the problems within those parameters becomes extremely important. Next, competitiveness. I'm afraid that most of the good executives want to win. They don't like to lose. People don't like to hear that, but good executives are very competitive. And they know when they are losing, by the way, and they get very much more mobilized. They get the adrenaline pumping. Dedication, even to the exclusion, to some degree, of one's family. Very difficult for women, by the way, because women are expected to be both a great mother and a great executive. Men are expected to do that, too. But women get more guilt about when they fail in some of these roles. But I'm afraid that dedication is still a very significant part of success in the executive arena. Just plain sheer devotion. You call in the man and you say, listen, Jack, you've got to fly to Chicago and get that order. Get out of here tonight. Occasionally, he may have a good excuse that his wife is sick or his kid is in the hospital. But if he goes 99% of the time, he's committed to the game of making your company successful. And finally, I guess, an understanding of other people, which comes from an understanding of oneself. You cannot understand other people unless you first understand yourself. And this is the beginning of all knowledge, is self-knowledge. And we'll have time to elaborate on this in later tapes. I've given you a large list. I guess, really, I tried to give you another characteristics, but if I were to factor analyze them, that is, to find out what is common in all of them, they would come down to 14 points. And for men and women who want to succeed and want to identify those who are capable of succeeding, let me give them to you again, just as to hammer them home in your thinking. One, judgment, not brilliance. What is referred to as just plain common sense. Two, initiative, the ability to take action when required. Not to wait for somebody else to tell you what to do. Third, integrity. By that I mean wholeness. Roundedness. What does integrity mean? They said this man has integrity. It's the sum of all the virtues, integrity. It means a roundedness, a substance.
Four, foresight. The ability, as one manager, one president company said to me once, the ability to see a quarter of an inch longer than the next guy. and that is dependent on your ability to watch trends. Fifth, energy and drive, just plain physical energy. Very critical, very important. You might be able to be an Einstein and sleep a lot of days, but you're not going to be much of an executive without a lot of just simple animal energy. Human relations skills, not just popularity. Remember, I had warned you against that with the Drucker quote. Human relations skills, that is the ability to cooperate, to understand, to have empathy, to develop those skills which permit you to comprehend what is happening around you. You know, somebody said some people make things happen, some people watch things happen, some people don't even know things are happening. Human relations skills are a kind of sensitivity to the subtle cues involved. Seven, decisiveness. I talked to you about that. The ability to make decisions. Eight, dependability. That is the willingness to say and to live up to the idea you can depend upon me. If I say I'll be there, I'll be there. Nine, emotional stability. That is not to be so confused by inner noise, by your own neuroses, by your own confusions, by your own needs, that you have a limited ability to understand others. You don't have to be totally healthy. Now, I call that the average neurotic serves very well as a characteristic of the successful executive. 10, fairness. The ability to say, look, I'm as fair with you as anybody can be. People respect that. It's when you play the favorites that I discussed earlier with you that you get into difficulty. 11, ambition. You must be ambitious. You must want to achieve. You must want to have a drive for competence. 12, dedication. We discussed this earlier. The willingness to make sacrifices. 3, objectivity. The ability to view yourself in the situation like a silent movie and say, there I am. Now, how do I interface with what's happening? The ability to view yourself almost like a capsule watching down on Earth. Like a space capsule. And 14, the ability to cooperate with others in a mutual endeavor. Ability to establish teamwork. The opposite of leadership is not non-leadership. The opposite of leadership is followership.
Dr. Feinberg concludes with advice on avoiding and handling stress.
There are things that you can do. You can take a conscious approach to handle your stress. You can take a positive approach to handling your stress. And I would like to give you recommendations, which I have done, try to do throughout this tape, which you can use on a daily basis, helping you to control your tension so that it will not result in either unproductivity or physical illness. Here are suggestions for tension control. Not to eliminate anxiety, because I don't believe that's at all possible in our culture, but rather to make it a servant rather than your master. One, face up to the tension. Fear or avoidance of tension can be more destructive than the tension itself. We know from many studies that the more aware the individual is of his tension, the more he struggles with the problem, the less severe any possible organic illness. If tension creates the feeling of being trapped, it cannot go on very long without causing you a lot of damage. Everyone needs to feel that there is something he can do about his difficulties, that there is an escape hatch to which he has the key. Face up to the tension and recognize you can have escape valves, that it is not unsurmountable. First, do not feel ever trapped. Always look at options. Always look at the situation and say, if there's a fire in the hotel, I know where the exits are. I will not panic. If I lose one account, I will not panic. There are a lot of other people out there in the world. If I lose this job, it's not the end of my life. If I lose my wife or husband, God forbid, I will find some other way to reclaim life. First principle, recognize you always have the ability to reclaim life until the last act. Two, take frequent physical breaks. Reasonable exercise is a tremendously healthy tension reliever. Swimming, jogging. I was raised in a generation who followed Chauncey Depew's advice to his friends that the only exercise he got was serving as a pallbearer at the funerals of friends of his who exercised. We were wrong in my generation. The only exercise I got was filling up the tub and then releasing the stopper and fighting the current. 5 minutes in the morning of touching toes with straight knees or walking around one's office at home will help. Stress in one area may be relieved simply by using other muscles of the body. For example, shifting a briefcase from one hand to the other, stretching your arms out while sitting at a desk, standing up with the arms outstretched, moving them in circles can activate your unused muscles. Next, watch your sleep. A critical, critical problem. You know, and I know, that when you get up in the morning and you've had what is called a good night's sleep, you feel fresh as the dew. A bright, sunny morning when you've had a good night's sleep. Now, what is a good night's sleep? Let's dissect that. I don't like to take things just at the superficial level. Let's dissect what is a good night's sleep. First, I think you have to understand there are what we call short sleepers and long sleepers. Short sleepers are people who sleep under 4 hours a night, and long sleepers are people who sleep more than 9 hours an evening. Now, let me add here that both short sleepers and long sleepers have three times as much of a chance of dying in the next 5 years as people who get so-called right amount of sleep. Short sleepers under four, long sleepers sometime over 9 or 10 hours. What is the best amount of sleep you should be getting? 7 to 7.9 hours per night. Now, what represents quality of the sleep, not just the number of hours? Quality of sleep is determined by your dreams. This is a relatively new phenomenon which you need to understand if you are to become more effective in controlling your tensions. Quality of sleep controlled by your dreams. Some of you say, I never dream. That's patent nonsense. Everybody dreams. Every night, and you dream in technicolor, some of you, and some of you dream in black and white, but the trouble is you don't remember your dreams, but you have them. Your mind goes crazy at night in order to remain sane in the daytime. Dreams are mental enemas, in which your mind is cleared of a lot of junk at night so that you can face the realities of the morning. Now, let us examine this dream part of your sleep state. What I will refer to now as the hygiene of sleep. The average person, almost every one of us, except some of us who are very mentally or physically sick, will be dreaming, and there will be some outward manifestation of that dream. It will be in the rapid eyelid motions, what is referred to as the REM, R-E-M, cycle. The REM cycle occurs approximately every 90 minutes. It is more likely to occur in the latter part of your sleep than in the earlier part of your sleep. And if you were to examine your wife or husband or your children and watch them as they are sleeping and look at their eyelids fluctuating, you were to disturb them and say, "What did you dream last night?" they will tell you. Now, they might tell you something else as well, so I would recommend that you do avoid this procedure. By the way, let me point out to you that if you disturbed REM sleep of patients in hospitals, you will find that they become cranky, irritable, and very neurotic and terribly tense because they have not had a chance to complete their REM cycle. Now, if the REM cycle then is so important, let me tell you that there's nothing you can do to increase the REM cycle, to increase the number of dreams, to increase the quality of your dreams. Why then do I mention the hygiene of sleep? Because there are things that interfere with REM. There are things that will block your REM cycle, and therefore you'll get up in the morning more cranky, more irritable, less able to face the day with confidence and with security. Let me then tell you what blocks REM cycles, and you avoid the blocks, and you're home safe. Or at least you will have better sleep, and you'll get up feeling much better and less tense. What are the things then that block REM sleep? Well, alcohol. You should stop drinking approximately 2 hours before going to sleep. Now, with alcohol, your body will go to sleep, but your mind will be knocked out and you will not have the quality of REM sleep. So alcohol is to be avoided approximately 2 hours before going to sleep. Next, do not exercise at night. Remember I told you to exercise? Don't do it at night. Exercise is better in the afternoon or in the morning. Third, stop your eating approximately 3 hours before going to sleep. Heavy stomachs do not tolerate REM sleep. Next, sex. Everybody thinks that's, that relieves tension. Yes, but unless it is very satisfactory, the Europeans are absolutely right. Sex is better in the afternoon than in the evening hours. Drugs, sleeping pills, tranquilizers, all interfere with REM cycles. Please throw them all out of your medicine chest. They are addictive. They knock out the REM sleep. They get you to sleep, and therefore you become dependent. I would prefer if you had toss and turn without worrying about the drug. Do not worry if you lose a night's sleep. You will be sleeping more than you think. Now, what about travel? Many of you listening to this tape, men and women now, are spending an awful lot of time, especially in sales and executive positions, running around the country from New York to California, California to Chicago, and you, or now in the world of the transnational company, New York to London, Paris, Kuwait, Bombay, are now becoming, names are on a commuter schedule almost. How should you handle air travel? Air travel has to be understood in the following way, because it does interfere with REM sleep, and that's why many executives don't understand why they are so cranky and why they're having so much trouble during a given week handling their tensions when they are in a different time zone. Remember, for every hour of travel change in time schedule and every hour of time zone, you need 1 day to make it up. So that if you move into 4 hour time zones, 4 hour difference in time zones will take you 4 days to make up the difference, make feeling yourself good again. However, there are ways to minimize that effect. Let me tell you a few of them. Do not smoke on the plane. Do not drink on the plane. Smoking and drinking will make it much more difficult for you to sleep that night. Next, start a trip in the morning, not at night. That is very important. Mommy, you say, well, I'll make up the time. I'll make that red-eye special to California from New York. It leaves at 6 or 7. I arrive the next morning, and I'm ready for the day. Stupid. You are ready for a basket case on the red-eye special. And another thing to remember is to do something different in the evening than you do during the day. Whether it's working at a hobby, participating in a community activity, simply watching television, the change of pace will help release the tensions, reduce the tensions that have accumulated during the day. Change of activity is the key. Next, learn to recognize your own individual tension triggers. Earlier, I discussed with you the measurement of tension levels. But I want to point out that you can tell when tension is getting to you personally by some of the particular unique warning signs that you and you alone know, that your own body reacts to. For some, the warning signs may be an increase in smoking. For others, it may be more than one luncheon cocktail. For others, it may be two or three or four nights of disturbed sleep. For me, personally, it's a tick in the right shoulder. Whenever I feel that I'm getting more and more tense, my shoulder starts jerking up and down in uncontrolled muscle spasms. For others, it's chest pains, diarrhea, constipation. You should know your own tension signs, and therefore, when they start hitting you, say to yourself, hey, boy, I got to rein myself in. Make a conscious effort to relax by changing the nature of your activity. Go out and give yourself a reward. Buy yourself a hat, a pocketbook, a golf club. The successful relaxation requires work. And it's important that you recognize that what are the things that give it to you? Next, the executive should stay with his problem. Usually, he must keep any number of projects going at once. He must bear, however, with interruptions. But he's got to come back to his problem. It is unfortunate that what we do is we tend to, in the human mind, need to have a feeling of completeness. And if you're too fragmented, you tend to never get that feeling. In one very important study, appropriately labeled Ulcers in Executive Monkeys, Dr. Joseph V. Brady of the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research found that intermittent stress was particularly destructive to the body. He pointed out that stress must be irregular if it is to cause ulcers. Continuous emotional stress seems to permit a stable adjustment under which ulcers do not develop. It is tempting to consider the analogy of the vacuum tube or the light bulb, which seems to last much longer under conditions of continuous current than when they are subjected to frequent heatings and cooling. This is why it is particularly important to impose order on those problems and activities that can be controlled. Jumping back and forth among tasks any more than necessary is asking for trouble. And the businessman should try to finish a job so that he can forget it, if possible, and move on to the next task with a feeling of satisfaction. He can help himself achieve the feeling of completion and reduction of tension if he makes it a habit to look back over his day and add up what he's accomplished and rather than what he has left undone. We have a very fancy word for this in psychology, call it avoid the Zeigarnik effect. A Zeigarnik effect is the effect due to the feeling of incompleteness of a task. And by the way, in your memory, you will often remember more often the incompleted than the completed task. Six, if a problem is really troublesome, try leaving it a while. This does not mean running away from difficulties. Retreat is a highly unsatisfactory way to handle frustration. But there is a difference between running away and moving back for a while to get a fresh perspective on the problem. When an executive is stumped by a situation, it may be wise to turn away from it and look at other challenges. In his biography of Bertrand Russell, Alan Wood said that Russell came to learn by experience that if he had to write on something difficult, he should think about it as hard as possible for a few hours or days and then turn to other matters. Months later, he would return to the subject and found the work had been done subconsciously. Before I discovered the technique, commented Russell, I used to spend the intervening months worrying because I was making no progress, whereas now I can devote them to other pursuits. Next, clarify personal values. One advantage of a personal philosophy is that the executive does not have to rethink each situation as it arises. He knows when he must stand firm with no thought of retreat and when he may yield without sacrificing his standards. For example, he may decide that no matter what happens, he will never maneuver another person out of the way to achieve a promotion, or that he will remain, inflexible on certain moral and ethical issues. You know, having the Ten Commandments saves you a lot of problems. Next, never nourish petty annoyances. These have a tendency to build up. One vice president tells how he faced many pressures as a result of a recent merger, and how his problems seem to center chiefly around one of his staff men. The man always comes into a meeting with his tie off and his collar open, he said. I recognize this is a small thing, but when I was under pressure, it always bothered me. It seemed to show a lack of respect for our meeting, and I found myself objecting at the meeting to many of his ideas. And I realized I was just hacking away because of my annoyance about his open collar and tie. I hated to say anything to him because it seemed so petty. Finally, I called him in and mentioned it. He took the suggestion quite well, and I feel better. So remember, never nourish petty annoyances. Sometimes get them out of your system. Next, get yourself some ability to work off pressure. When you feel tight, maybe you should have a punching bag in your office. Maybe you should have something to kick. Run around the block. The trick is to work off anger without lashing out at subordinates, husband, wife, children. The executive who feels like telling someone off should try pitching into some physical activity like carpentry, mowing a lawn. I try to hit a golf ball. Now, I want to point out to you that none of these things we have so far mentioned can eliminate tension entirely. And the wise manager learns that tension is inevitable and to some degree beneficial. As Dr. Hans Selye, the great tension specialist, pointed out, no one can live without experiencing some degree of stress. Crossing a busy intersection, exposure to a draft, or even sheer joy
are enough to activate the body's stress mechanisms to some degree. Stress is not necessarily bad for you. It is also the spice of life, where any emotions, activity, does cause to some degree stress. Sherlock Holmes once said, "I never remember feeling tired by work, though idleness exhausts me completely." The Danish philosopher Kierkegaard summed up the matter brilliantly when he said, "Learning to know anxiety is an adventure which every human being has to confront if he would not go to perdition, either by not having anxiety or by sinking under it." Do you know that the boys and the girls, the men and the women, who break up most easily under the pressures of an army situation are those who have not gone through life's tension situations? They have not graduated college, or they have not completed a job, or that they have been drifters. When tension hits, they tend to crack and do something very destructive. Now, let's go beyond just the handling of tension. I have observed in my practice for, as I mentioned, over 30 years of my life, very effective executives. What are these people like? What's inside their heads? One, they recognize the importance of some inefficiency. In life, stay flexible. Like the young people say, don't get so uptight in your ideas. Don't be so efficient that you can't flex and change with the shifts in the wind. Don't become so stuck on one project or one method of operation that you cannot move on to something else. A small degree of inefficiency helps a man survive when the environment changes. Next, set effective goals. Goals and objectives are essential to the proper conduct of yourself. Set effective goals commensurate with your abilities. Prepare yourself. One of the best ways to mobilize your talent is to know the issue at stake and prepare more thoroughly than anyone else to deal with it. I know one executive, a company president, who goes to extremes to prepare himself every time his firm approaches a merger. The man trains himself physically just like a prize fighter. No drinking, no late hours, plenty of sleep, and good and non-fattening food. He starts weeks in advance of the negotiation. He tells me he wants to maintain a keen mental edge. Next, don't try to be an expert at everything. You can't be. It's foolish to try. Few men achieve greatness in many fields. Da Vinci and Edison are among the rare ones who come to mind. But it's very difficult for most of us to do several things and do them equally well. Become an expert in one field and try to stay with that. Apply a tough criterion to yourself and stay within that. But don't try to be an expert in everything. Know your abilities and accept your limitations. You're human. You're subject to rage. The sex drive can be self-defeating at times. The great strengths you have could become your weaknesses if you're a good storyteller. You like very much to maybe spend too much time on the stories and less on the content. You have to allow yourself a few weaknesses. Acceptance is not resignation. Heed the advice of the great philosopher Gracian, who said, "Recognize the piece that you lack." There are many who, if they do not lack some attribute, could reach the peak of perfection. Some lack earnestness. A lack can tarnish great gifts. Others lack suavity of manner, a fault which soon lowers your esteem in others. Some want executive ability. Others want restraint. All these disabilities, if they are recognized and heeded, could be compensated for easily, and soon with care, a compensation could become the natural person. So try to recognize your limitations, accept them, try to change them, but don't fuss over them. Appraise your effect on others. Everybody needs to get some feedback to know the degree of their personal impact. Favorable feedback, of course, is easy to take, but sometimes unfavorable feedback can be even as valuable. Next, repeat your successes. By the time you've reached the middle rungs of the executive ladder, you must observe when your behavior wins you success and acceptance when it doesn't. Pick out those things you like to do and other things you like to see you doing and that bring you success. Concentrate on those things that you do well. Learn to live with failure. You will never gain self-confidence by telling yourself what you did wrong. Many famous people found success by picking themselves up and starting over again, even after miserable failures. They learned that life is a learning experience. In that losing, they learned something that might prevent them from losing again. Remember the words of Thomas Alva Edison, who tried 1,000 things that didn't work, but he persisted. He says, "Now I know 1,000 ways I can't make a battery." Get yourself a good manager or a helpful coach. This is, by the way, what many women executives have problems with. They don't have what we say in the parlance of management, a good rabbi. They tend not to have a good role model or a good coach. That's, I think, changing, but it's been one of the things that have blocked women in the executive arena. Get yourself a good manager or a helpful coach. Find someone who'll help you appraise yourself honestly and help you see things objectively. Make sure he's the kind of man who can tell you whether you've failed too often to continue or if you should persist with new knowledge. A good coach is an essential part of your tool of controlling and using your executive drives. And finally, cultivate the slight edge. The slight edge in life is going to make the biggest difference. The successful and effective individual is often only a little bit better than his rival who makes it to the grade. The great Dr. David Wexler, formerly chief psychologist at New York City's Bellevue Hospital, in his book, The Range of Human Capacities, most authoritative work on the subject, said the layman would find it difficult to read, so I'm going to give you just a summary of it. In strictly scientific terms, he said, the differences which separate the mass of mankind from one another with respect to any one or all of their abilities are small. Small differences make large differences in effect. For example, the difference between 5 feet 11 and 6 feet is admittedly small, but the ability to jump this extra inch may save a man's life. In a more humorous term, Dr. Wexler points out if Cleopatra's nose had only been a fraction longer, the face of Europe might have changed because Caesar would have been less interested in the lady. This is again an example of how small differences can be made larger in their effect. In baseball, the difference between a 300 hitter and a 250 hitter is only a quarter of an inch up or down the bat. The difference between myself and a professional golfer is one shot for each hole, and I will never live long enough to close that gap. The best way to end this tape is given to me by the great Kipling in a poem which underscores this point. And they asked me how I did it, so I gave them the scripture text. You keep your light so shining, a little ahead of the rest. And they can copy all they can copy, but they couldn't copy my mind. And I left them striving and straining a year and a half behind.
The Interaction Insight tapes are produced by the Bureau of Business Practice, Waterford, Connecticut, in consultation with Dr. Mortimer Feinberg.